Some of you know that I spent a lot of my adult life working as a teacher or a school psychologist or a principal. And one of the things that's really remarkable in public education, in any kind of education, but I worked in public schools, and you could see little kids begin to develop some moral compass. Sometimes it was a tedious and extended process. But you know, they started to get it. And so typically a little kindergartner kid comes in, and at home, you know, they're either the first of many or in the middle, but they are kind of special just because they're starting school. And they kind of think and have believed that the sun does rise and set on them. And when they get into a class with 20 other suns, they are quite mystified that they can't stand in the front of the line every day. Anyway, kids learn how to behave in a moral way to begin with because they might be afraid of a consequence, a punishment. And so they will not do something for fear of having something happen to them. Like one of my favorite little kindergarten girls wore those clunky kind of Mary Jane shoes and loved to kick other kindergartners with. And those shoes hurt. Now, you know, we went through all the steps along the way. The teacher talked to her about, oh, don't kick, you know, your classmates. And then there was a little conference with the parents. And finally it was, one more time you get to see Mr. Tartar. Which all the other kindergartners started to cry. I'm really a big teddy bear, but you know, it kind of worked. Anyway, so the kindergartner class was way down, and here's the walk, oh, in her scuffy shoe. Comes into my office, she's absolutely in tears, and you know, we had a little discussion about, you know, would you like it if somebody kicked you? Oh, no. Well, why are you doing that? Well, I want to be first in line. We worked it out, and she learned. But she learned, see? So she learned at least to behave a little bit because she didn't want to get in trouble. And she's truly was a great kid, and she is a great person. I mean, it was wonderful to kind of see her move through these steps. But she started there with punishment, right? I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do because otherwise I might get punished. There was no punishment for me. That was the secret, see? It was just enough to walk down the hallway. Okay. Now they get to be about fifth grade, and they've kind of worked through that stage, and now they are going to want to divide things out into what is exactly fair, which means good for them, and what isn't fair, which means good for you. And they wrestle with that, and then they talk about justice. So my favorite combination for them was justice, was to say, there's 600 kids in my school, you want me to treat you fairly, right? Yes. Okay. What size shoe do you have? Oh, six. All right, and those are boys' shoes, right? Yeah, okay. What if I buy, we're going to treat everybody fairly, right? I'm going to go to Costco just down the street, and the Seahawks, that football team, was right down the other street, and they would buy everybody. I said, the Seahawks will buy us all shoes. They were really a good team. Anyway, so I said, and we're going to go in, and I'm going to order 600 pairs of size 6 boys' shoes. Because that's fair, right? Everybody gets the same thing. So there's more moral development happening here. Why all of this ties in is that Paul, or the writer of Paul's letter to the Ephesians, is trying to move us beyond either, hey, stop doing this because somebody, you're going to get in trouble, or stop doing this looking for it's always fair. You have to kind of think these things in a more adult way. Now, you know, the Ephesians were kind of a rough and tumble group because he had to say, stop stealing, stop being lazy, stop gossiping. I'm sure that went over well. The point is, what he was saying, and he begins his conversation with these people, is we are all one. Now, that's a difference. See, it's not because I'm going to get in trouble to do something. It's not because I'm always seeking out that everybody gets exactly the same thing. I'm beginning to behave because I'm in relationship with all of the family. And the truth is that when I get to that moral development that talks about kindness above all and respect above all and love above all, then I realize that when I am being kind, I am building up the body, and I am also a part of that body. That my moral actions are not because I'm going to get in trouble. It's because we are one in Christ. It's a different way of seeing how we relate to one another. It's a different way of being in the world. Now, I'm going to be fair and honest with you that there are places that you can go and preachers that will preach to you and talk to you about you're going to get in trouble if. You can tell almost where people are in their concepts of God by where they are in their moral development. When we talk about God's mercy and forgiveness, this is something that is deep within the revelation of God, and something that should move our hearts, not out of fear, but to move our hearts in response to the love that God has shown us and gives us freely. That is what transforms our hearts. Certainly, we can get everybody to behave if we preach enough about hell. But the truth is, we don't want that. The gospel really doesn't speak about that. It speaks about transformation, which doesn't come from fear. It comes from love. It comes from love. So we have to look at ourselves and see us as God sees us, children, by God's design. Now, I don't really want to argue with God about that, because when he says, I sent my son to you, and Jesus called us friends and brothers and sisters, that is enough for me. Okay? Jeez, I don't want to get too fundamentalist about it, but Jesus said it, I believe it. Why? Because people can take the gospel and preach it in a way that keeps us in fear. This reading that we did, and we're leading up to a thing in Ephesians that parallels the story of the prodigal son or the prodigal child, which is a story of mercy and hospitality. We believe in a God who loves us, and it is that love that transforms our hearts and how we relate to one another. I'm sitting at my Irish grandmother's dinner table, and you bet when I was six, I knew not to pick up my fork before she said, you can eat now. Why? Because I probably would have gotten in trouble. Later on, I realized that sitting at my grandmother's table was a celebration of love. Nobody told me to behave well. I wanted to be the best that I was because I was so deeply loved, and I love these people. You see, there's such a difference in that. That's where we are, is that knowledge of God's love for us as a people. That is what Ephesians is calling us to. We are one with God. We are one with each other. Ephesians ends with this beautiful phrase, which, should you want to do something this week, would be a lovely thing to do. It says, therefore, so I'm going to back up a little bit. Paul has told us all these things to not do, and then he said, do these things. So it's very kind of clear. Be imitators of God as beloved children, and live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself for us a fragrant offering unto God. I want to pause about fragrant just for a second. Do you know how magnificent it is to step into a garden and smell the flowers? And how, even if you close your eyes, the fragrance, the beauty of those flowers is evoked through the scents that are in that garden. This fragrance, this delicious, beautiful image of being a fragrance of love, that it is through our love that we are giving perfume, that sense of beauty, that sense of harmony, that sense of magnificence to God, to be a fragrance of God. In conclusion, why did Chris preach my sermon? Thank you, Chris. So, you know, a Franciscan's always going to try to land on their feet, right? So I've said all these beautiful things, at least I hope they're beautiful. But the point is, we have to do something with this, right? So I've encouraged you to know and be so more in touch with God's love and presence inside of you, and let that love transform you. Let that love bring you to blossom, to scent the magnificence of creation. I've encouraged you to do that, to set aside some of that fear stuff that doesn't work and get to the stuff that does, which is love. And now, in the gospel, Jesus says, I'm the bread of life. We heard this last week. And at the end of the gospel, they're beginning to not like him because he's not as entertaining. He says, you're looking in the wrong place here. I am the bread of life. And he ends the gospel today with this radical way of saying it. I am the bread of life, and the flesh that I give is flesh for the life of the world. So, here's the sermon. Thank you, Chris. You see, there are folks in this world that need a place to live. And you, in your kindness, and in your generosity, and in your love, these big ethical things, right? You could choose not to give anything to the refugees. Who's going to beat you up and get you in trouble? See? This congregation is responding because these people are in need. There is love there for our brothers and sisters. Brothers and sisters we don't even know. Do you see that connection? That ethical action is being made. So, to give an example of everything that I've just talked about, is what Chris talked about. This group of people, amongst others, but this group of people is making an effort specifically to help strangers find a place to live, to give them a home, to give them shelter, to give them comfort. We have no idea what they've lived through to come to here. And it is your kindness and your love and your generosity that for them gives them this bread of life for a new beginning, a place to live, a place of safety, a place of peace. You and I, my brothers and sisters, are this bread. We give this bread of love to those who are hungry. And in the process, we build up the family of God. Let us walk in love as Jesus taught us, not fear. Let us walk in love as Christ loved us. Let us be a fragrant offering unto God.